listening to the Banana Republic, and I say good morning because it's morning here, but I know that many of you, it's close to midnight, so good evening and good night for later when you all go to bed. A little earlier, I was hanging out in Stoke Sauce's studio, and that was the intro, the drums. He was just mucking around, and I pressed record. and then he started fiddling on some keyboard or another, and I took that as well. Hope he won't mind. Alrighty, let's get into it, my fine friends. Let's see what Scott's got to say. Let's see some of the clips I've recorded, pre-recorded. Let me make things up as I go along. I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you for being here. And before I go too far, let me mention Froggy's show. Not last week, but the week before. It was incredible. It was really nice. I loved it. And Stoke Sauce and I listened to it returning from the beach later in the afternoon, I think on the same day. And it fascinated me, so I had to re-listen to it. So, Froggy, that was a great show. Thank you. You can see why I enjoyed that, can't you? Well, I really did. Thank you, Froggy. All right, I hope you're ready. Scott visited the other evening, and we were in Stoke Sauce's studio, and we were chatting, and this is what he had to say. It's quite long. I hope you enjoy it, but it's the conversation. It's how things panned out. I liked it, and I hope you do too. All right, here we go.
Luke? And it's on the... That's what they used to use there, the recording. And, you know, tomorrow, and it's Michael Mansell going around the corner. That's what they used to use. That's the whole thing. Get your mouth up to it so you get the right distance every time. Cool, eh? So, record this thing. You're recording. So this show is called Eric. And it's awesome. It's set in, like, by 1979, 1980 in New York City. Now, you remember, like, that was a pretty rough time in New York because... The subways hadn't been cleaned up, so lots of homelessness, very similar, ironically, to now, but like before the big sort of cleanup happened and everything. So basically, the main character is this guy who's a puppeteer, like Jim Henson, you know, he do the Muppets, and he's like almost bipolar, I suppose, you know, like genius, creative genius, yeah. But like really abusive to people, hard ass, a bit of an addict, eventually big addict, you know, obviously he's like snorts coke and drinks a hell of a lot, but mostly he's an alcoholic, useless husband. But the thing is he fights with his wife quite a lot, and the sort of casualty is their little son, okay? And the son sort of cowers away and disappears in like his own world and draws beautifully. He's a beautiful artist like his father, because his father obviously drew all these characters to make these puppets. Anyway, one day the son just disappears, can't find him, and the story runs basically that it's the cops trying to find the kid, the father trying to find the kid, but at the same time, struggling with his alcohol issues, His father is this massive like businessman who runs all the development in New York and wants the homeless people out. Anyway, kind of long story short, basically, the young kid actually disappears into the sewers to go and live with the homeless people. So he doesn't get kidnapped. He goes voluntarily because he's sick and tired of his parents fighting. But everyone thinks that the kid's being kidnapped. And so the cop who goes looking for him is a black guy who is not loved in the police force because all the racism, and also because he doesn't really sort of toe the line, you know. He sort of like does his own thing, but he looks after missing persons anyway. And this sort of parallel stories running with his own sort of challenges and this thing. But the cool thing in the story is because the father is bipolar, he imagines this other character which he calls Eric, and Eric happens to be like a monster. So wherever the father goes, he has this massive monster like following him around, who's this sort of like puppet monster, but it's all in his head. And he starts having arguments with it because he's an addict, and he's, you know, he's like delusional and he's got his own condition. But the monster like is his second personality. So like he speaks and he'll say something like this, and then the monster will be like, oh yeah, what are you thinking, man? You're just a useless father. And it's cool. You gotta watch it. It's such a great show.
I'm not sure I'll enjoy the movie.
No, I think you'll enjoy it. It's a good series. It's a good series because it like builds, but mostly what's cool is seeing New York at that time. Because even though
it's an old movie.
It's a new movie now, but they've recreated like old New York in late 70s, yeah, early 80s. So, but it's really nicely done.
So it's like Mad Men.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, yeah. So it's a recreation of that period, but you wouldn't really know. But at that time, you know, it's sort of set in like, you know, New York, which is a mess, like on all levels. Like, you know, the super wealthy living their life, but then like passing the workers all day in the street. But like right next to them is like a world of homeless people who are really struggling. And a lot of them are just struggling with their own stuff. Either life's been cruel or they've got an addiction.
Does it touch on music from that era?
Oh, there's plenty of music in it. Some really great music. And it varies from Talking Heads to some of the late sort of 70s stuff that like New York Dolls.
Television.
Yeah, like Television, that sort of thing as well. So there is a bit of a punk sort of scene, the sort of back end of the punk scene. But a lot of it's really around this kid's escaping. But man, he draws beautifully. The kid, I don't know if the kid drew in it, but he draws the most beautiful pictures of like his life. But there's this other cool character. So he lives down in the sewers,
yeah.
But he befriends this, I think the guy's a Haitian or a Jamaican dude. He's got big dreadlocks in it, and he watches out for the kid. He like locks the kid up during the day when he goes out to do his job, so the kid's safe inside like his little compound that he's built there, and the kid draws on the walls and that. And everyone thinks that this guy has kidnapped the kid, you know, because they find some CCTV footage and they see him going off with him and say, oh, this dude must have taken him after all, you know, after all. And it goes over about maybe a two-week period, but it's awesome. But the best thing is this development of this character, this Eric, who's the monster. And so he is a, like a Muppet, you know, he's like a... Like he's a you know, foam and fur created creature following the dude around, but it's all in his imagination. So he's almost like living his alter ego through one of his creations. It's really clever. Clever show. So that was cool. We're also watching The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which is pretty harsh.
Yeah, you've said you've enjoyed that. Yeah. I don't know, I'm not sure I can watch those sort of movies.
Oh, it's a series.
Really?
So what's interesting with it is, you know,
comes up in my feed. And
not the Nazi thing, not Auschwitz, none of that really. It's a love story, and it's a sort of a love story which is really between a guy and a girl who meet. He's a tattooist who does the numbers on people's wrists as they come in, you know, and he has to know who they are.
After I watched Dior.
Yeah.
Christian Dior, that was an awesome series. It was about 4 or 5 episodes.
I heard so, yeah.
Hey, I loved it.
Yeah.
And anyway, after that, The Tattoo of Auschwitz kept coming up in my feed.
Yeah.
But I was like, I looked through it and read up about it, and I was like, I'm not gonna. I don't know.
the theme is intense.
Yeah.
But interesting enough, like as he's older and he's writing his memoirs, because it's sort of set between different times. One is like said in 2003, just before the main character obviously passes away as a 90-year-old man. Mm. But he's writing his memoirs, and a woman sort of is helping him write it. And then, obviously, then you slip back into 42, when this all kicks off. But and he's writing it in Melbourne, so it's like he's in Australia. So there's a bit of reference to like our world, and it's all bright and sunny. And then you go back to 1942, and there are days where it is sunny, and you realize that. Yeah, we know all the history, we know all the harshness, but you also realize there surprisingly were probably moments of. Bit of beauty, a bit of...
Oh, there always is. Whenever humans are involved, there's beauty,
But this is... Even if
it's slashed and torn.
Yeah, I mean, this is... I mean, the horrendous stuff. So there's one scene we watched last night where one of the German guards, who's obviously a real sadist, he knows this guy is one of the tattooists, and so he tells the Jewish this guy to go into the gas chamber and identify two bodies there, because he can't tell what the serial numbers are on their wrists. And so then this guy has to go in and say, oh, that's 7913 and the other one's 7918. And he goes, oh, I thought they had the same number. And so he says, well, you're the only Jew who'll ever get out of this gas chamber alive. And that's a harsh sentiment in itself. That's
very creepy. That's horrible.
It's like you're the only Jew who's ever gone in and come out. And we all know the story, we know the harshness of it, but there's something really special about the those little moments,
even the bits inside of Dio, when the sister gets, because she was part of the French Resistance and she gets sent in, and that was quite destroying, soul destroying. And but it ended happily, actually. Really, I like that.
Mm. Yeah, see, I didn't know that was on. I know there was another fashion house that they had a while back on as a series. It was the Italian one, Versace. Mm. And I hadn't seen that myself. Oh, because, really? Yeah, I'm interested in, obviously, the with being a designer and that, and being interested in how... the fashion world is different to our design world in the sense that it's probably closer to art, and it's probably why Lucy got involved in it so much with textile design, is that you can be known for a style and you own that style, and in a way you're kind of known for producing a certain look.
But do you think there is still fashion? Do you really think people... This is my problem. I don't know that... That sort of, yes, it is art, but it was art then. It's not art now. It's manufactured. Jules goes hunting for stuff, right? And he gets really good stuff. I wish he'd wear more of his stuff that he gets. But talking about him for one moment, I went to a store and I saw this guy there, and I was just chatting to him, and I said, yeah, I wish my son would go to Melbourne, because that's where... And he goes, like, how old is he? And I said, oh, he's 21. And he goes, Melbourne is the best place on earth at this time for a 21-year-old to be involved in music.
Mm. I suppose back to your point about fashion and style. Look, I still think there is fashion that's being created, but I don't believe... And it's a little bit like music. Years ago, you belonged to a tribe. You kind of subscribed to a certain aesthetic and you loved fashion houses because they kind of created things. Or people even... Take Vivienne Westwood. She was almost the antithesis of a fashion house, but invariably became a sort of a fashion icon because she created a style. And, it feeds you. Next thing, it starts making you famous. And the next thing, you're wealthy. And they probably all started that sort of way in some to some degree. But in years gone by, right up until, I'd say up until the 90s in truth, really, fashion was about choosing a tribe. And you followed your tribe, rockers wore leather and punks wore, whatever, and you were goth.
Haircuts, focused on
haircuts. Yeah, haircuts and stuff. That a lot of that's fallen away in the sense that they were waves that came and people went after the wave, and some people rode it and some people went under it and all that. Nowadays, there are just too many waves. It's like there's no way of knowing what, and the quality isn't there enough to be able to make you want to join the tribe. You might ride the wave for a few minutes and you'll bob and catch another one. And that's unfortunately what I think has happened throughout.
It's like cars. If you look at cars, they're all the same. There's no really stylized car. If you want a stylized car, you have to go and get an older car.
Totally. And it's,
or a really, really new car.
Yeah, or totally. Or you accept. I mean, there's an interesting advert, and you've got to see it. Somebody did that very example. They said, like, you know what an SUV is? You know, a sports utility vehicle. And, like, they list, I kid you not, like 40 manufacturers, and all the vehicles are white, just a white vehicle. And it starts at the top, like, say Audi, and it ends at whatever, like the Zephyr or whatever. And the shape of the vehicles are just homogenized. They all look the same.
That's my point.
They all look the same.
So if you're a mod or a rocker or a punk or anything in the modern world now, or if you try to be, you're going to the normal stores to get your gear.
Yeah.
There's no, there's no underground
movement for that, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But even in those times, as you say, there was mainstream. There was Marks and Spencers. There was Woolies. There was lots of stuff. But you rebutted that and you went looking for people to make original new stuff.
But that's also what I'd like to say. Back then, you could go to a tailor.
Sure.
You can go to a cobbler. Everything you could even go to cabinet makers and furniture makers to
make. Look, I think you still can. The difference, though, nowadays is that, I don't know, I think some of it's down to the desire for people to seek out like what really is innovative and new. And that unfortunately has now become the trapping of the wealth classes. So like if you're a Kardashian or you're a super wealthy Kanye West or something, sure, you can be at the cutting edge of fashion because it's about wealth and prestige. Whereas in the old days it wasn't. It was about standing out and being like flying your flag. It was like choosing a flag.
Mm.
And it's not like that anymore. It has one of the saddest things because
it has, but it's moved away from fashion and frivolous things to more serious things and more tribal things, much more.
But I think in terms of as fashion goes, you know, if we talk about fashion for a minute, you subscribe to a look in that. Nowadays, and it was probably started a while ago, but we rebutted it. You know, people like, you know, Chanel, people like Louis Vuitton, all these things. These are old brands. It's not like they didn't exist before. And the wealthy classes definitely went in them, but there were always people champing at the bit with doing something that was different.
And they recreated themselves. All of these brands recreated themselves.
Yeah, you had to reinvent yourself. You had to, yeah.
Several times.
You might have had an aesthetic that was yours, and whether or not you were Burberry, you always kept the, like, you know, the herringbone kind of pattern. But you kept pushing it. Maybe we're just so out of touch with that now, Rolls. I don't know. I'm not saying just you and I, but maybe society is because there's just too much. And maybe that's continuing. But I just haven't noticed it, you know.
I think when you have kids, you're pretty much right in the middle of it. There's a period when you go right through the center of it. Sure. Because they go through it.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, as you said now, what you're talking about Julian. I mean, Julian's actually actively looking for his own flavor, his own style, creating his own flag. Mm-hmm. That's great, but unfortunately, a lot of it is by looking to the past, not so much to the future. We often look at thrift shops and go and find stuff from the past and then subsequently create something that can inspire. It's very rare that someone's going to say, I'm going to go buy some fabric and I'm going to make myself a coat.
You know, I heard a really good extract from Blaise Pascal from the 17th century about looking at the past or looking at the future and not living in the present. Actually amazing. I'm going to put it on my show because I was like, hey, you should check this out.
I'd be interested to hear it. But I think it is challenging. There's a really interesting video at the moment from Rick Beato, which no doubt you've watched, which is where he's trying to explain, you know, what is the problem at the moment with music being like it is. And very similarly to what I was just saying, and I think we almost, you know, mutually arrived at a similar point, because I think a lot of people have thought that the problem at the moment is not that there's not great stuff being made. There's lots of young people doing awesome stuff out there. The trouble is there's a lot more terrible and a lot more of it being offered to you, to an audience that otherwise doesn't really know what good and bad is any longer. It's just a lot of really, really over produced nonsense, and that's the challenge. It's not a lot of people out there, oh yeah, music used to be better years ago. in some ways, our competency had to be pushed to a higher level. You had to work harder to get a really good result. Now, nowadays, you don't. The technology, like, you know, auto synths and, you know, vocal correction software and stuff like that has meant that...
Same as graphics.
Take Canva, you take AI and stuff. Yeah, you can produce a seemingly good result, but it's not original. It can get pulled apart very easily.
Yeah, it doesn't cut.
It doesn't stay, and it definitely cut through. Yeah.
It won't cut.
But it is true. When you watch, you must watch that interview or that thing he puts together, because you can imagine there's lots of comments where people are saying, "Oh, you're just an old boomer." And he goes, "Hang on, it's not about age. There are lots of young people producing amazing stuff at the moment, but the problem is there's a lots of stuff out there that's really, really, really terrible."
Jules and this girl went out the other day to Brisbane to listen to a particular band, and he said it was cringeworthy because they were doing covers of ABBA or mixing it up, but they blistered it. And it was just so destroyed that, you know, because they're not living it.
Mm.
They don't live it. They haven't felt it and been there. And that's just a simple example.
Mm.
But they're so in the moment enjoying being up there, it's not a real thing. I don't know. I got it secondhand, so I don't actually know what it was like. But he came back with this criticism.
Look, ABBA was a unique thing. ABBA...
No, this is not about ABBA. This is about the band.
No. I'm saying, but to explain that and maybe try and... ABBA was a unique thing in the sense that they kind of exploded out of nowhere with an interesting sound, which seemed to, for some reason... like switch a light bulb in that everybody in the world kind of needed. You know, it was sing-along stuff, it was irreverent, it was fun, it made you dance, it kind of was clean. It was almost like everything the Swedes sort of stand for and the rest of the world kind of got it, like IKEA furniture. You all just got it. Like, where have you been? And then the trouble, though, is like when you go back and try to then either deconstruct it or try and copy it, it always sounds like a pastiche. It always sounds... crap, because really at the end of the day, the first time round, like switch the light bulb on, and we've been living with that light bulb on for a long time. We put the radio on, it's like, hey, Dancing Queen, blah blah blah. But when you hear somebody else try and mash it up, you go like why are you breaking that? It doesn't need to be poorly done. It just needs to be done the way it should be done. And unfortunately, it highlights an interesting point about music that really you couldn't and shouldn't really mess with, because it doesn't need your input. Other music does. There's lots of music that you reinterpret, but somehow ABBA is one of those things that's irreverent. It's not quite throwaway, but it's irreverent. It's just reasonably light-hearted. There's enough sophistication for the music pundits who want to go into it and go, oh, okay, that's a diminished ninth that he's playing, and it tickles your ear somehow.
It's a wonder that musicians haven't replied to other songs. So almost like a duet, when a song comes out and it runs for a while and it says something.
Mm.
It's quite surprising that other musicians don't either follow on from that thread and continue with it and write another chapter, or offer a rebuttal or a comparison against it. So instead of doing remixes, you're stealing remixes,
sure,
and wrapping it up in a new package and then playing it in with another message or a continuation, an opposite message or a similar message.
Yeah.
No, look, you're good.
I think it has been done, and like, as you're saying that, there are things in my mind that I'm going, yeah, somebody's written that, and then another artist will come back with a thing that kind of, you know, I know for a fact the Beatles and the Stones did that for a period of time, and there was a bit of interplay with one another where they'd write something and then they'd write another song where you could quite easily construe that it was written about the other piece. But you're right. I mean, that has... I think it commands a lot of attention, and whether or not, you know, people have that much interest in following that for very long is another thing. Bear in mind, as we said before, in days gone by, you would swear an allegiance to a band. You'd like tattoo them on your arm. Nowadays you don't. You like swear an allegiance to the song that's playing now, but it'll be finished in a few seconds.
So true.
You know?
Rachel's back. Hey, Jules.
How's it?
What you doing, champ?
Trying to edit this
video. Look, what can you tell us?
Control for this. It's not Zoom.
What can I tell you? About what?
Anything.
It's not doing anything. I'm trying to make good. This software, you can adapt. You can.
What's going on? What's happening in the world of
you can, like, assign it.
Teenagers?
Okay. What is this?
What's happening in the world of teenagers?
Switch the speaker.
I don't know, man. I feel like John Elliott probably be a better. Smart actions.
What, you just recluse at home and read books?
I don't know. I mean, like, what am I doing?
What did you learn on your trip overseas?
I learned, obviously, about different cultures and stuff going overseas.
Right.
I think the main thing was
it just has weird stuff
gaining a bit of independence.
Sells me
You know,
a bit shaky.
Yeah, I was just saying, but these are kind of the first time ever being like away from the family for a long time.
Yeah, that would have been a nice experience.
Interesting.
You know, it was fun.
Kind of like enjoy mama's cooking after that again.
You know, I got a bit of freedom, got to kind of make my own path and do my own thing. It was fun. But like you said, you come back.
Would you do it again, or would you go?
Yeah, for sure.
Would you like to go to like a more third world country next time?
Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to go to Thailand or Vietnam or something, or maybe South America.
Get the brand, the Melbourne brand.
You know, because I was one of my jobs is working with all the Argentinian kids when they came over to learn English.
Mid-range.
The original ones,
and I learned a bit about their culture, and they're very nice people.
Yeah.
Original. And a lot of them were very open to talking about how life is like back home in Argentina.
So you click on that.
Obviously, the differences between Western culture and their culture is massive. I mean, have you ever heard of a thing called mate? Mate, it's like a tea they drink over there, but it's. I didn't realize how part of the culture it is in terms of the fact that mate is just like, it's like hot water and herbs they pour into like a clay pot. And there's a big metal straw in it. But the thing is that only one person makes it in a group. Only one person makes it. And when they make it, you're not allowed to touch the straw, or you're not allowed to stir it, or you're not allowed to drink, like, it's... Say as an order of people, you're not allowed to break the order that it goes around. Because it's considered cheating the other person if you're having too much or whatever. So it's like... the first time I had it, I touched the straw and they all freaked out. But apparently it's a respect thing to the person who made it. Is if you mix it around, and you're saying basically that they didn't make it well or whatever.
Really?
So they freaked out a bit. But it's a big thing apparently in their culture. It brings, like, it's a thing you do with your family and a thing you do with your friends. And it's supposed to symbolize... relationships that you have with other people, and if you have a good relationship, you'll share the matter with them. But yeah, that's something I learned talking to the Argentinians. But they're amazing people. Same with the Brazilians.
Funny you should say that, because we have a lot of them up at Noosa, and they really are lovely.
Yeah.
And original too, and unique.
Yeah. Well, they offer like a fresh perspective on things.
Yeah. I think I agree with you there. That's actually a nice destination.
Yeah, you know, Argentina, Patagonia, that kind of those places would be amazing to go to, and see in Chile as well. But yeah, definitely something I'd like to do.
Awesome. All right, friends, that's all we have time for. That was us hanging around Stoke Sources studio chatting. You heard Luke, Scott's son, you heard Scott, you heard me, and of course you could hear Stoke Sauce in the background. So take care, see you guys next week. Bye.